We cannot say what man's place is in this mechanical universe. There is no proper definition of consciousness, nor explanation of why in mystical experience and in near-death experiences we see the universe as composed of love. We need a science of values, and with that will come a much better appreciation of man's place in the universe. So morality and experience come into science where they are not at the moment. The exciting thing is this new science is almost here. Physics is already pointing the way, and I think psychology will also start to go along that line. Then we will have the beginnings of a science of mind. Despite the seeming evidence for psi powers, like telepathy and action at a distance, the belief is widespread that mind is just an aspect of the working of the brain. Of course, the brain itself is composed of atoms, and so the quantum effect of non-locality might therefore apply directly to it, holding out the possibility that one day physics will not only accept psi but is already part way to understanding how it works. However, it is certainly true that most people not only know nothing about quantum, but if Isaac Newton has fallen off his throne, they have not been told. Should we accept the scientific view that we are machines made of flesh run by a brain which is a glorified computer? Dr. Roger Penrose, an Oxford professor of mathematics who has recently written a book on quantum, told me he did not share the view that the brain was a computer. It could be demonstrated that certain mathematical insights could not be obtained by calculation or computation. Science was a long way from understanding the nature of consciousness. We don't have the physics yet. Dr. Fenwick speculated that the knowledge waiting for us around the next scientific corner might be that the universe was not a solid and material place but composed of love, consciousness and mind stuff. He fell back on more orthodox science when I asked for his assessment of life after death. If you are asking a scientific question, then you are tied up with genes, hereditary factors, brains, bodies, and it's quite clear they don't survive. If you are talking about subjective experience, you are asking a non-scientific question, and the answer will be non-scientific. There is no reason why personal experience in some form or other should not continue. The only reason we think it doesn't is that we link it quite incorrectly with modern day science. Now, if you take that away, it's equally likely that some part of personal experience may have a wider distribution than just in the brain. There is no evidence either way, and maybe some of the studies now taking place may push one to the conclusion that some form of survival will turn out to be more likely. Today, the majority of scientists definitely seem happier with Reformation science than quantum theory. According to the polls, only 1 in 5 scientists accepts the possibility that their mechanical universe may be prone to paranormal phenomena. Things have not changed. Back in 1953, the famous biologist, Sir Alistair Hardy of Oxford University, gave 4 reasons why his scientific colleagues would not accept the findings of psychical research. Firstly, the experiments often could not be repeated in a laboratory, which is perhaps a less valid objection today after years of Ganzfeld experiments. Secondly, the scientists suspected the phenomena were caused by fraud. Hardy acknowledged there were charlatans who pretended to have supernatural powers but told his colleagues, "The great science of chemistry sprang from the cradle of alchemy, some of whose exponents were genuinely striving after the transmutation of metals and the elixir of life, while others were as rank impostors as any false medium or fortune teller of today." Sir Alistair was too polite to mention that Sir Isaac Newton himself was an alchemist, or that numerous orthodox scientists have been caught cheating and falsifying their results. The third objection was that parapsychologists seemed to want a particular result to their experiments, making critics suspicious of their findings. Were they biased and ready to arrive unwittingly at false conclusions? Hardy said, "If we say science must only be concerned with experiments about whose results we have no emotional feelings, then we can never hope to come to a real understanding of living things." Finally, orthodox scientists could not bring themselves to look at psi research because they believed it to be impossible and a waste of time. Hardy's reply was that to refuse to investigate telepathy because it did not 114 appear to fit the framework of present-day science, was to be the same as those bigots in the 17th century who condemned Galileo for his experiments and conclusions. Some parapsychologists today have faced opposition reminiscent of the old days of Galileo and the Inquisition. Dr. Michael B. Sabum of Atlanta, a well-known researcher of near-death experiences, has faced critics and made a relevant observation in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1980. Dr. Blacker points out that the physician must be especially wary of accepting religious belief as scientific data. I might add that equal caution should be exercised in accepting scientific belief as scientific data. Most scientists who concede the possibility of the paranormal do so from some personal experience and not because of the strength of the evidence. Sir Alistair Hardy was a case in point. He came to believe in telepathy because of two experiences during the First World War. He was serving with a cyclist battalion in England, when he went to tea with a Mrs. Arthur Wedgwood, an amateur medium. This lady knew that Hardy's brother was a prisoner of war in Germany, and she told the young officer she could see his brother in a little room, with a camp bed, sitting at a table. On a large sheet of white paper I see him painting what seems to be squares and oblongs of red and blue. Hardy was surprised, because Mrs. Wedgwood had described exactly what Hardy himself had been doing that afternoon. His colonel had asked him to prepare illustrations for a lecture on the Franco-Prussian War. That afternoon I had cutting out squares and oblongs of card painted red and blue to represent various units of infantry and cavalry. I spent the afternoon in my spare room with a camp bed, looking at a map and moving red and blue cards about. I then went straight on my bicycle to have tea with Mrs. Wedgwood and am absolutely certain no one could have told her what I had been doing. Could it have been coincidence? A year later, Hardy was again having tea with Mrs. Weekers in London. He was now a camouflage officer with the Royal S and that afternoon had been doing experiments in dazzle effects. Fuslis painted a large sheet of white cardboard with vivid pink distemps, watched it dry on a table in front of him. As soon as he sat down opposite of Mrs. Wedgwood, she said, "What have you been doing? I see a large pink square on the table in front of you." Some scientists cannot understand how others can be so foolish as to have such beliefs, Dr. Fenwick commented. "You have to understand cognitive dissonance. I know that smoking may kill me, but it doesn't mean I stop smoking. Scientists hold opposing views at the same time. Scientists live in a world of mechanical fact. They cannot square their science with their own perception of the world, so they compartmentalize, on the one hand, a Christian and on the other hand a scientist who really believes the communion wine turns into blood, and they are not prepared to do an experiment to see if they can find hemoglobin present. That would be inappropriate." Chapter 27. Looking for White Crows. Concepts which have been proved to be useful in ordering things, easily acquire such an authority over us that we forget their human origin and accept them as invariable. Albert Einstein. Does this book's collection of strange lives and events, supported by the testimony of scientists, amount to a plausible case for life after death? The primary concern of the scientists was always the integrity of their research. They always seemed aware of possible alternative explanations like hallucination, extraordinary coincidence, self-deception, fraud or telepathy. But if the subjects, unwittingly or wittingly, deceived themselves and us, it wasn't apparent from their evidence or attitudes. Western adults often had to overcome a fear of being ridiculed to speak out about their experiences, and there was the shy assurance of Asian children who behaved and spoke like older persons whose life and death they remembered. Fortunately, all the cases don't have to be equally strong to undermine the materialist rule that death annihilates life. The 19th century American psychologist William James said that to demonstrate all crows 115 were not black, you need only find a single white crow, just one was enough. On the face of it, the parapsychologists have a flock of white crows. Credibility and crows to one side, the first thing we tested in this project was psi. If survival was possible, we needed to show that a human being was more than flesh and cerebral cortex, all destroyed at death. ESP, telepathy and clairvoyance were telltale signs of some mind force that might exist outside the brain, perhaps even capable of surviving the death of the body. Charles R. Norton's computerized analysis of years of Ganzfeld remote viewing tests seemed to demonstrate statistically that Psi was real. In labs across the country, blindfolded subjects had correctly picked one of four targets with a 1 in 3 frequency, a clear improvement on chance, and some of the individual successes were impressively detailed. Our own recorded remote viewing test, supervised by parapsychologists Dr. Keith Harry and Dr. Nancy Sondo, was an astonishing success. Tessa Caudill of the BBC saw an unknown location with the clarity of a genuine eyewitness and drew, on a single sheet of paper, the salient features of the small park where Dr. Sondo was standing. Nothing was drawn that was not represented on the target site. It was every bit as impressive as Mrs. Wedgwood's demonstration of Psi for Sir Alistair Hardy. By Ganzfeld standards, of a single picture on a slide, she scored 5 hits in 1, since she separately identified a T-shaped path, a small park with trees, a structure with steps and a pointed roof, a shop with a red and white striped awning and the statue of an angel turning green. Psi seemed effectively demonstrated, but Dr. R. Norton raised a serious doubt about what it might mean for life after death. Telepathy is a double agent. It makes survival seem plausible by identifying a force which could operate separately from the brain, but R. Norton suggested telepathy might also produce the evidence that is generally taken to indicate life after death. It's easy to see how this might apply to seances. Mediums who tell sitters strange truths they seem to have no normal way of knowing, may be getting the facts telepathically from the minds of the sitters. It was more difficult to relate R. Norton's theory to Dr. Stevenson's cases of small children who recall previous lives of people they and their family know nothing about. Is it feasible for a child to have unconscious access to some general pool of information about dead people? If the child telepathically gets such information, why should the infant imagine he or she had once been that person? Dr. Stevenson also pointed out that these children mostly show no other signs whatever of telepathic ability. In the second of our searches, there were compelling narratives about apparitions and near-death experiences. Dr. Melvin Morse has a powerful collection of drawings by children close to death and was critical of routine scientific explanations that near-death experiences were hallucinations in a dying brain or some reliving of the birth process. It was difficult to doubt the sincerity of witnesses whose brush with death in many cases seemed to change their lives. Particularly significant was the hospital worker's story of recovering a shoe from a ledge, after it was seen by a patient having a heart attack, who simultaneously found herself floating out of body around the outside of the hospital. This seemed to corroborate the claim that a near-death experience is at least a genuine out-of-body experience and not a simple hallucination. This non-locality, the ability to be in two places at the same time, was central to much of the evidence we looked at. Is there now hope of a scientific framework for this concept in quantum physics? In 1964, the physicist Dr. J.S. Bell published a mathematical paper which offered this possibility, and numerous eminent physicists today think Bell's theorem is supremely significant. Dr. Brian Josephson told me, "It is one of the most important results in science in recent decades. You compare it with things like quantum theory itself or relativity. In Bell's theorem, things in different places can be directly connected. One consequence which might be relevant to survival is that a well-defined structure doesn't really have to exist in any particular place. It can be spread around everywhere, interacting with itself through the kind of connections Bell discovered. Quantum theory is a minefield of possibilities. The paranormal has not been accepted into the body of science, but that remains a possibility for the future, partly because quantum has blown apart the certainty of traditional scientists that such phenomena were beyond the bounds of credibility." Another eminent physicist, the Reverend Dr. John C. Polkinghorne, the president of Queen's College, Cambridge, gave me a view of quantum and survival. "Quantum mechanics has taught me something very surprising," The world that seems so solid and reliable in everyday terms is in fact made up of particles which are elusive and fitful in their behavior, when we get down to the atomic and subatomic level. It's taught us two things: the world is full of surprises and is more subtle than we might have expected. Secondly, whatever the world is, it is not 116 merely mechanical. The physical world of ourselves is part of something more subtle, more interesting, more open to the future than elaborate pieces of clockwork. If you're going to discuss the question of destiny beyond death, you have to decide what might have a destiny. Some people believe the real me is some sort of spiritual ingredient, a separable soul which is sitting here inside the body. It is indestructible and therefore survives death. I don't think human beings are like that. I don't think we are apprentice angels. I think we are minds in bodies, and that is the soul, if you like. The real me is not an extra, spiritual ingredient, but is the infinitely complex information-bearing pattern within the matter of my body. Perhaps the most intriguing idea to come out of a mass of speculation about quantum is that reality might be consciousness or thought. The old idea that matter was composed of particles has given way to the idea of fields. Einstein referred to matter as frozen energy. If the energy in the fields is thought, does that mean each of us is a thought form? Thought is a force which might operate independently from the brain, producing telepathy, apparitions and out-of-body experiences. At death it presumably quits the body and perhaps find a new body, a reincarnation, or it simply moves to a dimension of mind, inaccessible to our five senses. So what should we make of it all? If the stuff of the universe is mind stuff, as Sir Arthur Redington said, then the observer may indeed interact with the experiment. The physicist Niels Bohr said, "We are both onlookers and actors in the great drama of existence." Quantum science may be telling us that our individual consciousness, some part of our mind, is our own little bit of eternity, a fragment of the underlying reality of the universe. Of course, as Dr. Josephson pointed out, mystics have been telling us something like that for many centuries. The main difference is that they call the fragment soul. But these are areas of speculation and belief a long way from where most of the scientists dropped us. Whether the evidence has demonstrated life after death, or reincarnation is clearly for each of us to decide individually. My own beliefs have changed somewhat in the 2 years it took to make these programs, and in an unexpected way. I was on holiday in Spain with my family in 1990 and spent every afternoon working in a hotel room. I had with me Tegwin Hughes' account of his apparitional experience in a Malta convoy, when the destroyers Erith Husa and Ryan were attacked. I was also researching the complexities of the cross-correspondence The Ear of Dionysius, a series of communications to mediums. One morning in a Spanish market, I saw 3 blackened coins on a stall. I was told they were Roman. I liked one and bought it, with no other ideas about it. I kept it with other coins in my pocket. Months later, we were filming with Dr. Antonio Mills in British Columbia, Canada, and in the library of an academic, my assistant Tessa Caudle, with no specific aim in mind, pulled a book from one of many shelves and opened it. On the page were pictures of my coin, a head on one side and a racing chariot on the other. The caption said it was a 5th century BC coin issued by Dionysius, the tyrant of Syracuse. The head on the coin was the goddess Erythusa. That day in Spain I had unknowingly picked up an object specifically bridging the 2 separate stories I was working on. Carl Jung had a theory of synchronicity to link up coincidences which sometimes made the past appear to overlap the present. He wrote that the coincidences may be so extreme that their unthinkability increases until they can no longer be regarded as pure chance but, for lack of a causal explanation, have to be thought of as meaningful arrangements. The coin came to symbolize the project, a true talisman. Even the place and manner of its identification by my psychic colleague seemed significant. Today, I believe in the possibility of life after death and reincarnation as perhaps a next stage in the evolution of human consciousness. But I am convinced of 2 concepts, telepathy and synchronicity. I have seen both in action and have my copy of Tessa, S drawing and the coin in my pocket to remind me, the world is full of surprises.